This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 1 Chronicles. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the book of 1 Chronicles chapter 6 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
The Merariites, they carried the frame, the poles, the sockets, and the boards and so forth of the tabernacle. So the Kohathites carried the tabernacle furniture. Gershon carried the tabernacle fabrics. Merari carried the tabernacle frame. When you get to heaven, there will be a quiz. Verse 31 begins with an interesting genealogy. Now these are the men whom David appointed over the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark came to rest. They were ministering with music before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of meeting until Solomon had built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and they served in their office according to their order. And these are the sons who ministered with their sons. Of the sons of the Kohathites, Heman the singer was the first one. Then drop down to verse 39. And his brother Asaph, who stood at his right hand. And then move down to verse 44. Their brethren, the sons of Merari, on the left hand, were Ethan. Now these verses record the genealogy of the three priestly divisions established by David to do music in the house of God. The sons of Heman. And by the way, you can read one of Heman's songs. Psalm 88 was written by Heman. The sons of Asaph. And Asaph, you can read several of his songs. He wrote 12 of the 150 Hebrew Psalms. And then the sons of Ethan, who was responsible for authoring Psalm 89. And you know, what a great job to get. These guys were paid just to hang out in the temple and just fill the place with praise. Anybody want that job? We all do. Hey, David knew the priority of praise and of worship. He knew that God inhabits the praises of his people. Thus, David filled the tabernacle. He filled the temple daily with praise and with worship. Verse 49. But Aaron and his sons offered sacrifices on the altar of burnt offering and on the altar of incense for all the work of the most holy place and to make atonement for Israel according to all that Moses, the servant of God, had commanded. Aaron was Israel's first high priest. His sons would succeed him. Now these are the sons of Aaron: Eleazar his priest, his son, Phinehas his son, Abishua his son, Bukai his son, Uzi his son, he carried a machine gun by the way, Zerahiah his son, Merioth his son, Amariah his son, Ahitub his son, Zadok his son, and Ahimaaz his son. There were 12 high priests from the Exodus to the exile, 12 high priests over a period of 900 years. Now chapter 6 ends with a list of 48 Levitical cities. You remember the Levites were the one tribe that were not given a territory. The Lord, not the land, was to be their inheritance. They didn't have a parcel. They had a person who they were to be connected to and in love with. They were to be in love with the Lord. And so the Levites, not having a tribal territory of their own, they were given certain cities to live in, scattered throughout the other 12 tribes, 48 of these Levitical cities. Notice 1 Chronicles chapter 6. Notice 1 Chronicles chapter 6. Notice how many verses it has. It has 81 verses. Just for fun, can you name for me the two other chapters in the Bible that have more verses than 81? Can you name one? Psalm 119, that's easy. How many verses does it have? 176 verses. You guys are so smart. Can you tell me the other chapter of the Bible that has more verses than 1 Chronicles chapter 6? 1 Chronicles 6 has 81 verses. Can you name me the other chapter that has more verses than 1 Chronicles 6? Numbers chapter 7 has 89 verses. And so, again, you'll be a big hit at the next trivia night. You got the top three chapters with the most verses. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 5, lists the genealogy of Issachar. Verses 6 through 12, the tribe of Benjamin. Verse 13, the tribe of Naphtali. Verses 14 through 19, the half-tribe of Manasseh that settled on the west bank of the Jordan. Verses 20 through 29, the tribe of Ephraim. And notice verse 27 mentions one of the sons of Ephraim, a man by the name of Joshua, the other faithful spy along with Caleb. Verses 30 through 40 list the final tribe, the sons of Asher. And the two tribes whose genealogies are missing for some reason are Zebulun and Dan. And I'll let you try to figure out why those two tribes are missing their genealogies here. Chapter 8 is a more exhaustive listing of the genealogy of the tribe of Benjamin. King Saul, remember, was Israel's first king. He was a Benjamite. And so chapter 8 is really Saul's genealogy. Saul's father Kish had four, and his four sons. Saul's father was Kish, and then Saul had four sons, Jonathan, Malchishua, Abinadab, and Ithbal. They're mentioned in verse 33. Now this Ithbal goes by another name. Anybody know? Ishbosheth. It was the other name. And you'll recall that after Saul died, Ishbosheth ruled over the northern 10 tribes for a brief period of time until David finally took over and consolidated the kingdom. But this Ithbal was also Ishbosheth. Chapter 9 begins. So all Israel was recorded by genealogies. And indeed they were inscribed in the book of the kings of Israel. But Judah was carried away captive to Babylon because of their unfaithfulness. And the first inhabitants who dwelt in their possessions, in their cities, were Israel, the Israelites, the priests, the Levites, and the Nethinim. Now the Nethinim were servants who worked in the temple, but who were not Levites or priests. They were sort of like Adrian. They were summer interns. You know, they weren't Levites, they weren't priests, they were just guys that we kind of recruited to help out, you know, for the summertime or something. So that's what the Nethinim were. Now between verses 1 and 2, there's a time lapse of 70 years. It's interesting, Ezra skips over Judah's time in Babylon and focuses on the first Jews to return to Judah. His focus is not the time in Babylon. That was a time of judgment, a time of punishment. He wants them to start over again. And so he wants to begin where they begin, in the land, rebuilding the kingdom. Understand, Judah was deported to Babylon in three waves, and they returned from Babylon in three waves. The first return was led by a man named Zerubbabel. And his goal was the rebuilding of the temple. The second return was led by Ezra, the writer of the Chronicles. And Ezra's desire was the rebuilding of the people. Ezra was a priest. He had a heart for the people. So he wanted to rebuild the people. The third wave was led by Nehemiah, who rebuilt the walls. And so remember that, the three waves, the three returns back to Judah, Zerubbabel and the temple, Ezra and the people, and Nehemiah and the walls. Chapter 9 describes those who came back to Judah with Zerubbabel. Verse 3. Now in Jerusalem, the children of Judah dwelt, and some of the children of Benjamin and of the children of Ephraim and Manasseh. And he provides a list of names. He says 956 people settled in Jerusalem. A large contingent of priests also returned. Verse 13 gives us a total and a description. 1,760, and they were very able men for the work of the service of the house of God. The temple was still in rubble, but these were pioneering priests. These were guys that were ready to serve. These were guys who came back to Jerusalem with their shirt sleeves rolled up. Oh, how we need these kind of people in the church today. People that are ready to work. People that are not afraid. Who are able people for the work of the service of the house of God. The house of God is still in need of these kind of people. And then verses 14 through 16 list the names of the Levites who returned. And then verse 17 lists the gatekeepers. And notice it says, Shalom was the chief. Now the gatekeepers were like the ushers. Okay, now this is a word to the ushers right here. The gatekeepers were the ushers, and evidently Shalom was the lead usher. Let's read, begin reading in verse 18. Until then, they had been gatekeepers for the camps of the children of Levi at the king's gate on the east. Shalom, the son of Kore, the son of Ibbesoph, the son of Korah, and his brethren from his father's house, the Korahites, were in charge of the work of the service, gatekeepers of the tabernacle. Their fathers had been keepers of the entrance to the camp of the Lord. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, had been the officer over them in time past. The Lord was with him. Zechariah, the son of Meshelemiah, was keeper of the door of the tabernacle of meeting. All those chosen as gatekeepers were 212. Not many, really, for the various gates throughout the temple. They were recorded by their genealogy in their villages. David and Samuel the seer had appointed them to their trusted office. So they and their children were in charge of the gates of the house of the Lord, the house of the tabernacle, by assignment. The gatekeepers were assigned to the four directions, the east, west, north, and south. And their brethren in their villages had come with them from time to time for 7 days. For in this trusted office were four chief gatekeepers. They were Levites. And they had charge over the chambers and treasuries of the house of God. And they lodged all around the house of God because they had the responsibility. And they were in charge of opening it every morning. 1 Chronicles chapter 9, verses 17 to 27, Ezra discusses the ministry of the temple gatekeepers. And again, ushers and greeters are the modern day version of the gatekeepers. If you're an usher or if you're a greeter here at Calvary Chapel, you play a vital role. For you pave the way. You prime the pump for folks when they enter our church to worship God. This is no small responsibility. You are their first impression. Gatekeepers were also troubleshooters. They anticipated needs, and they dealt with any distractions before the interference upset someone in the worship. They made sure that the flow of worshipers moved smoothly in and out of the temple. There were many functions for these gatekeepers or these temple ushers. Notice also they were in charge over the chambers and treasuries of the house of God. They made sure nobody ran off with the offering box. Major responsibilities. Now I want you to notice 6 points about the gatekeepers that also apply to being an usher. First, it was a needed position. You can write that down. A needed position. Thousands of worshipers would come to the temple daily. During the feast, the numbers swelled to hundreds of thousands. And there were numerous gates. Folks came from various angles. There was much to oversee. This was a needed position. Second, I want you to notice, this was a coordinated position. Notice verse 17 tells us that they had a chief named Shalom. Verse 23 says that their tasks were carried out by assignment. In other words, they had a schedule that they kept. Everybody was on the schedule. Verse 24 indicates they were assigned a specific direction to cover. East, west, north, and south. Sanctuary, foyer, children's ministry, playground. And they were organized for ministry. Hey, this was a coordinated position. Notice the third thing. This was an important position. Both verses 22 and 26 call the role of an usher a trusted office. Gatekeepers represented God. People were coming into God's house, and you're His host. Do you realize that, guys, if you're an usher? You're God's host. You're hosting people into His house to worship Him. This is a trusted office. This is a sacred trust. Verse 21 calls the gatekeeper the keeper of the door. That's a heavy role to play in God's house. That means you control who gets in and who gets out. The keeper of the door. You got into the temple through the usher. You were escorted out of the temple by the gatekeeper. And the same is true here at Calvary Chapel. Get rowdy. Start heckling the pastor. Create too great a disturbance in the worship, and the church ushers will show you the door. Notice fourth, this was an honored position. A needed position, a coordinated position, an important position, and an honored position. Notice verse 19 says the gatekeepers were part of a heritage. They were following in their father's footsteps. You know, being a gatekeeper was like going to the same college as your dad and your granddad and your great-granddad. It was sort of part of a legacy you were carrying on. These guys grew up looking for, oh, one day I'm going to get to be an usher at Calvary Chapel. One day it's going to be my turn. One day I'm going to be a gatekeeper. They were excited about it. They grew up looking forward to this privilege. And then fifth, it's a responsible position. Notice verse 26, they had charge, which means they were given authority to make decisions. Verse 27 tells us it was their duty to open up the temple every morning. In other words, the worship of God started on their cue. Can you imagine a heavier responsibility? And notice too, they lodged all around the house of God because they had the responsibility. The obligation that the gatekeepers felt toward their ministry was so strong that they even moved in from outlying areas. And they moved their families in around the temple so they would be there. They could live nearby to take care of their duties and their responsibilities. Notice sixth, it was a spiritual position. And if you go back and look in verse 20, it mentions Phinehas, evidently the first leader of this order. And here's what it was said of him. The Lord was with him. And you know, guys, to be a good gatekeeper, to be a good usher, you have to be empowered by the Lord. You need the joy and the discernment and the patience and the firmness and the love of the Lord. Gatekeepers need to be led and controlled by the Spirit of God. Now, those of you who are an usher or a greeter here at Calvary Chapel, understand you have joined the ranks of the ancient gatekeepers. And so I'm here tonight to admonish you to live up to their high standards. I'll never forget the event that forever upped the ante on what it means to be an usher at Calvary Chapel. So those of you guys that are ushers, you know, we joke with you sometimes, we laugh with you sometimes, but you know what? Your job is vitally important, and you are following men like John Calmer, who took it seriously and who held it in high esteem. And God, you're God's host. You're a host for God in His family and in His house. What more honored position could you have? Verse 28. Now some of them were in charge of the serving vessels, for they brought them in and took them out by count. In other words, some of these guys handled the communion trays, you know, whenever the church had communion, the serving vessels. And some of the gatekeepers were appointed over the furnishings and over all the implements of the sanctuary. In other words, they moved chairs. And they brought in the big ladder whenever one of the stage light bulbs blew, you know. They took care of moving the furniture and all around and so forth. And over the fine flour and over the wine and over the oil and over the incense and over the spices. And some of the sons of the priests were made the ointment of the spices. In other words, the gatekeeper's job was to change out the deodorizers in the restrooms, the spices. Now, Mattathiah of the Levites, the firstborn of Shalom, the Korahite, had the trusted office over the things that were baked in the pans. Verse 32. And some of their brethren of the sons of the Kohathites were in charge of preparing the showbread for every Sabbath. These are the singers, heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites, who lodged in the chambers and were free from other duties, for they were employed in that work day and night. What a great situation. These musicians on the payroll to do nothing but to sing praise to God. The temple was always filled with wonderful praise. Now the rest of chapter 9, verses 35 through 44, once more recounts Saul's family tree. The death of Israel's first king is the topic of chapter 10. Now the Philistines fought against Israel. And the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons. And the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and abuse me." He was afraid that his longtime nemesis, the Philistines, would torture him like they tortured Samson if they caught him alive. You remember what they did to Samson? They plucked out his eyes with a hot poker. And Saul wants his armor bearer, his personal bodyguard, to just go ahead and kill him. But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. I mean, by this point, Saul is a pathetic figure, but he's still king over Israel. Therefore, Saul took a sword and he fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died. And so Saul and his three sons died, and all his house died together. Now, 1 Samuel chapter 1 indicates that Saul's suicide attempt may have failed, and that his death may have been hastened by an Amalekite who happened by at this particular time. You can go back and put these two events together, the account here in 2 Samuel chapter 1. And when all the men of Israel who were in the valley saw that they had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook their cities and fled. And then the Philistines came and dwelt in them. And this, of course, was the low point for the nation Israel. And so it happened the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. You know, pouchers have now come out and they're going to take away the gold and take their watches off and clean out their wallets and, you know, just kind of rip off all of the corpses lying on the battlefield. And they found Saul and his sons, and they stripped him, and they took his head and his armor. And they sent word throughout all the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among the people. And then they put his armor in the temple of their gods and fastened his head in the temple of Dagon. And they did this to mock not only the king of Israel, but also to mock his God. 1 Samuel 31 tells us that the Philistines also nailed the body of Saul to the wall in Bethshan. And some of you who've been to Israel with us have been to Bethshan. This was where Saul's corpse was literally nailed to the wall. Now verse 11 tells us, "And when all Jabesh Gilead heard all that the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons, and they brought them to Jabesh and buried their bones under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days." And so out of respect for a king of Israel that had fallen, these men of Jabesh Gilead, they invaded Bethshan and they took back Saul's body so that they could give him a decent burial. Verse 13. "So Saul died for his unfaithfulness, which he had committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. But he did not inquire of the Lord. Therefore he killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse." Notice it wasn't the Philistines that killed Saul. God killed Saul because Saul had been unfaithful to God. He had failed to seek the Lord. He instead had consulted with witches. Saul died because of his disobedience to God. Make no mistake about it, Saul died at the hand of God.
You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams, here at Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is teaching his way through the book of 1 Chronicles. Do you have a favorite, cherished item that's been in your family for longer than you can remember? Who gave it to you? Who had it before them? There's a rich history behind such treasured items. And so it was with King David and his faith in God. He wanted to make sure that he passed down to his descendants what he knew to be true of God. Will you pass down the blessing of God's strength in your life? How about his faithfulness? At sandyadams.org, we would love to answer any questions you might have or pray with you. Just find the contact tab at the top of our page and you're all set. Or you can call us at this number, 770-736-2828. Again, that's 770-736-2828. While you're there, why don't you stay a while and listen to some past teachings or download our mobile app? That way, you can dive into God's Word with us anywhere you are at any time. That website again is sandyadams.org. Well, that's about all we have time for today, but we look forward to continuing this study with you in the next edition. Thanks for listening to Sandy Adams Radio.